Hey, assalamu alaikum, everyone.
Alaikum salam.
Before I begin, I want to just first thank Sister Amina and the other organizers for this conference. I was just saying that it's really nice to actually have a space to talk about these subject matters in ways that are very complex and sometimes a little uncomfortable. Sometimes we need those spaces, and it's really great to be able to participate and be part of that space. So I just wanted to begin by saying that. And also by saying that, right now, my research is in its very early phases. It's still kind of being formed and developed, so I would appreciate as much feedback as possible. But in essence, what really drew me to this topic was just kind of a personal experience of seeing the term Shiaphobia utilized so much just in day-to-day conversations, and even just online, just people hashtagging Shiaphobia, for example. And it was really intriguing to me that people were using this term, but not really, defining it. And people were just kind of using it in all these different ways. I saw it hashtagged along with Iranophobia. And so it was just kind of, troubling to see. At times it was troubling to see in what ways it was being used and what ways it was not being used. So to kind of illustrate an example, this is a picture of the recent Hajj application, right? That's how they issued, in which they ask you not what madhab you are you Sunni, are you Shia? They ask you specifically, are you Shia? So if I were to post this picture up on Facebook or Twitter, because that's where you hashtag, right? Put it up on Twitter, hashtag Shiaphobia. Most people would probably not even question. They would say, yeah, that's Shiaphobia. But we haven't talked about it. We haven't really defined it. So I find this to be very intriguing. And so the beginning portion, the title of my paper is Right to Offense, Right to Shiaphobia. I'll talk about the offense portion in a little bit. Basically, this presentation has two parts to it. The first part is going to be me actually defining and conceptualizing Shiaphobia. And the second part is going to be a rhetorical analysis of seeing this sort of rhetoric in action. And I'm using two different texts as sort of a case study for this. I'm going to be looking at the Sunni scholar, theologian Yasir Qadhi, and how he frames offense in two different texts. First, he was part of an interview for Press TV, which took place here in London in June of 2014. And he was actually explicitly asked questions about his views on Shiaism. He has a history of being very anti-Shi'i, and he was giving this interview to say that he's actually gone away from it. So that was one. And I wanted to look at a Friday sermon he delivered in response to the attack on the French publication Charlie Hebdo. And specifically, I'm going to be looking at how it is that he framed anti-Sunni rhetoric and the offense that stems from that, and compare it to the way that he framed offense in response to the French publication. All right, so first, defining Shiaphobia. I draw on Salman Said's recent essay in which he argues a, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Heideggerian, Wittgensteinian approach to Islamophobia. Essentially, what he argues is that it's more accurate to kind of define Islamophobia by its various deployments. So the way in which you see Islamophobia occurring in different places, and you can kind of categorize it based off of that and naming it, being able to identify something and name it as such. That's how he's defining Islamophobia. So we could also say that Shiaphobia can follow a similar definition in which it's defined by its various categorizations and its various deployments on a global scale. So this can include things like the systematic target killings of Shi'i Muslims in Pakistan, the history of systematically destroying places that are significant to Shia theology, such as the Baqi Cemetery in Saudi Arabia, the targeting and imprisonment of Shi'i scholars. I put epistemological next to those two because I think those have epistemological implications to do that. The complete or partial banning of Shi'i commemorative practices in certain Muslim countries, the institutionalizing of anti-Shi'i policies, and they've been recently done in places like Egypt, Malaysia, where Shias are an overwhelmingly minority, and of course the mass production and accessibility of anti-Shi'i literature. So this is just a general list. So to talk a little bit more about within our context in the US, Canada, and Western Europe, I think first and foremost, it's important to understand that within these contexts, Sunni Muslims essentially occupy the position of what's called the norm. They are the dominant group. And in order to understand how that works, and especially when we talk about dominant groups, oftentimes the dominant group is afforded this privilege of being the invisible group. So the way this would look like in these regions is Sunni Muslims have the privilege of just being Muslim, whereas Shia Muslims have to be Shia Muslim. We can also see this kind of play out in the way that certain Muslim institutions run in these regions. So, for example, I have a couple of examples from the U.S. Zaytuna College is becoming a U.S.-accredited liberal arts college, and it offers a BA in Islamic law and theology, but it does not include Shia jurisprudence as part of their curriculum. Large-scale national conferences such as Mass ICNA really neglect to invite Shia speakers, and they don't really face any pressure to do so. And if we wanted to consider even just more generally Muslim organizations that, you know, for example, might take off for Eid, right? That might seem normative, but it would be unusual for them to take off for, like, Ashura, for example, right? So the idea that, like, not being inclusive, or the idea that being inclusive of Shia Muslims and Shia practices, that being abnormal indicates that there is a norm. Does this make sense? So, in essence, it's important to recognize that there is a Sunni norm in these regions. And the reason why is because when we're talking about sectarianism, we have to understand that as the Sunni group is the dominant group and they are the normative group, they essentially have the ability to define sectarianism in a way that would privilege their perspective while silencing the group, the group that is marginalized, right? So, in essence, sectarianism, when employed by the dominant group, will privilege the way that it impacts them. Anti-Sunniism sectarianism will be emphasized while silencing anti-Shi'i sectarianism. And what's even more interesting is that it does so by reducing anti-Shi'ism to matters of theology, thereby inherently denying Shias the ability to speak about their own experiences. And this could include everything from violence to everyday microaggressions. To this latter point on theology, I think it makes sense that because the Sunni tradition maintains dominance through a theological identifier, that theology itself is instrumentalized to suppress the Shi'i voice. I want to clarify at this point that while we're addressing Shia phobia, this is not an attempt to nullify, silence, or rationalize the existence of anti-Sunniism within Shia communities, which is certainly a problem and does contribute to sectarianism in various parts of the world. But in order to understand why we shouldn't use the term sectarianism and why there is a need for the term Shia phobia, essentially, we need a way to understand sectarianism from the perspective of those who are disproportionately affected by it the most. The term Shia phobia arguably allows us to carve a discursive space to address this, and more generally, to name the process by which Shi'i identities and subjectivities are constructed in regions where they occupy a marginalized position. Within the context of North America and Western Europe, Shia phobia is exercised subtly through the use of rhetorical tropes that center Shi'i otherness on the basis of theology. I argue that this grants the Sunni majority permission to remain silent, ignore, or entirely erase the realities of systematic violence occurring against Shia Muslims on a global scale. So this is very broadly how I'm defining Shia phobia. All right, now let's move on to the analysis. For those who don't know who Yasser Qadhi is, he is a well-known Sunni scholar and theologian. As I mentioned before, the purpose of the interview that he had on Press TV, he was trying to say that he's kind of moved around, like moved beyond the sort of like anti-Shia rhetoric. And so I'm gonna take a look at that and the way that he talks about offense in there. And also to give you a little bit more background about who Yasser Qadhi specifically is. Am I on time?
There's time.
So, he is currently the Dean of Academic Affairs for Al Maghrib Institute. It's an Islamic education institution that provides seminars and classes worldwide. He's involved in several initiatives. He's given lectures around the world, and he has over 192,000 followers on Twitter. So that gives you an idea of how prominent he is. To describe my actual methodology of what I'm doing, this is called a critical rhetorical analysis. And Macaro, to kind of illustrate with this a little bit more, argues that the task of a critical rhetoric is to undermine and expose the discourse of power in order to thwart its effects in a social relation, and that by doing so, a critical rhetoric serves a demystifying function by demonstrating the silent and often non-deliberate ways in which rhetoric conceals as much as it reveals through the relationship with knowledge and power. So, first and foremost, to get into Yasser Qadhi, I should probably clarify it. Right now I'm going to talk about the interview a little bit. I can't go verbatim for every single thing that he said in the interview. He takes a long time sometimes answering questions, so I'm just kind of taking pieces from his responses.
Anti-Sunni or anti-Shi'i?
This is anti-Sunni. Yeah. So first and foremost, I'm going to add, like, he was posed a question about anti-Sunni rhetoric. All right. So the question that was posed to him was essentially, like, talking about power relations. And somebody, or the interviewer, Roshan Mohammad Saleh, he asked him, you know, he said, comparing anti-Sunni rhetoric coming from Shias with anti-Shia rhetoric coming from Sunnis is a bit like comparing anti-Black racism to anti-White racism. They're just not on the same level. Now, this was Yasser Gadhi's response to that. I don't feel qualified to comment on that. Just because Shiites are statistically a minority, I don't know if it's fair to portray them as being the underdog all the time. I mean, the type of inflammatory language that I heard myself, there are extremist Shiite clerics online and here in London and others, their rhetoric is simply vulgar. It is beyond what is even decent and normal. And then throughout the course of the conversation, it becomes clear that he's referring to Yasser Habib, who is a London-based Kuwaiti scholar. I myself didn't know that much about him until this interview. But it turns out, yes, he is very anti-Sunni. And it even he didn't explicitly say this, but it's very clear that Habib has actually accused the Prophet's wife, Aisha, of murdering the Prophet. And this was something that, like, you know, Gadhi clearly expressed, like, a degree of offense for that statement. So the thing to note here, though, is that in doing so, that the question was posed about power relations. First, he denies that there is a power difference, right? And the second thing is that the framing of his anti-Sunni rhetoric is strictly on the basis of offense for theological reasons, meaning what constitutes Yasser Habib as someone that is anti-Sunni is in the way that he offends Sunni Muslims through rhetoric that is simply vulgar, beyond what is even decent and normal. Here are the implications for centering this argument on theology. First, it grants him permission to disregard those power differences. It paints instances of anti-Shia violence and rhetoric as isolated events, and it rationalizes this violence to even a degree. So at this point, I'm going to quote Stuart Hall. Stuart Hall says, the circle of dominant ideas does accumulate the symbolic power to map or classify the world for others. Its classifications do acquire not only the constraining power of dominance over other modes of thought, but also the inertial authority of habit and instinct. It becomes the horizon for the take it for granted, what the world is and how it works for all practical purposes. So if we were to kind of apply this to Yasser Gadhi, essentially the way that the person who's interviewing him, Saleh, responds to that question, he says, okay, Habib does this sort of stuff, sure. But what about people like Sayyid Sistani and Sayyid Khamenei, who have explicitly issued statements telling Shias not to curse the companions of the Prophet and not to curse, you know, the wife of the Prophet. And his response is, I might agree with you there, that's true. A lot of Sunni Muslims might not know about that. But as I'm saying, we have this difficult issue where you are focusing on the grievances of one group, but there are grievances on the other side as well. And he ends with by saying, maybe sometimes this issue is a matter of Sunniism, maybe sometimes Shiism. What we see here is Gadhi's ability to disregard the fatwa by very prominent Shi'i clerics that hold much more power than Habib, particularly on a theological level, and instead map sectarianism in ways that classify anti-Sunniism and anti-Shia aggressions as equal. This then privileges Habib above Sistani, and it dismisses anti-Shia violence as isolated instances. So if we were to draw a parallel with race relations, what we see happening in the United States is a lot of, like, this whole, like, Black Lives Matter movement. The way that people who are critical of, for example, white folks who don't experience the sort of, like, anti-Black racism in the United States, it might be very easy for them to look at all of these things that are happening in the States and be like, you guys are making too big of a deal out of this. These things are not connected, right? And saying that sectarianism is essentially equal, and that aggression is kind of equal on both sides, you're able to kind of dismiss and say, no, this is an isolated incident, this is an isolated incident, this is an isolated incident. Does that make sense? So, in essence, am I okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. So what we see here is his ability to do that. And so much so that at some points he actually rationalizes violence. So this is, at one point, Saleh explicitly asks him this question about, okay, we've talked about anti-Sunni rhetoric. What about anti-Shia rhetoric that's exercised by Sunni scholars? It's very normative for them to do that. So this is his response to that question. This is literally the first sentence. In this type of violence, I'm not justifying, but just put yourself in their shoes as well. they will find comfort in stereotyping the other. Again, he makes it equal, right? Both sides are going to find comfort in hurting the other. You cannot speak the rhetoric of Gandhi. I'm speaking from the comfort of London right now. I'm speaking from the comfort of America. But I cannot and will not pretend to be a Syrian scholar speaking to the Syrian people and an Iraqi scholar speaking to the Iraqi people. So what we see him in his kind of his response to this question, first of all, he doesn't talk or he doesn't even address the question about anti-Shia rhetoric or violence, right? And the other thing is that though he says outright that he does not justify this violence, he certainly does not condemn it either. In fact, in asking the listeners to put yourself in their shoes, arguably rationalizes his violence, which is reinforced by his own personal removal from the context. I cannot and will not pretend to be a Syrian scholar. And just to kind of end off, I'm actually just going to end off with this quote. Like I said, I don't have time to go through the entire lecture, but just specifically when Gandhi was speaking about the attack on Charlie Hebdo, and he brought up offense, he said that we have to condemn this violence, disassociate ourselves from the people who committed this act, but notice at the end he says, we have to point out that violence is not occurring in a vacuum. And then he says that we have the right to be angry. Again, he's not answering a question at this point, right? This is a different context. He's not in an interview process. He's speaking to his own community at this point. So he's saying we don't have the right to get physical, we don't have the right to harm, but we have every right to be angry and offended. And then again, he ends with, but I do say that there are other circumstances that created this violence. And the reason why I wanted to end with this quote is because this essentially demonstrates why I wanted to focus on, like, the trope of offense, is because I felt like it was deeply relevant. I think that there was this feeling amongst Shia Muslims when this incident happened, and there was this sort of, like, condemnation of what happened, Charlie Hebdo, but there was this sort of, like, recognition of that violence not coming from nowhere, as to why Shia Muslims oftentimes are not granted that same degree of, you know, well, maybe this anti-Sunnism and this anti-Sunni rhetoric is coming from somewhere. Not to rationalize it, but it's completely decontextualized. So, in sum, the purpose of this comparative analysis was to illustrate how Shia phobia emerges within the US, Canada, Western Europe, through the normalized use of certain rhetorical tropes. And all of these tropes are rooted in theology. So, I analyzed Yasser Gandhi specifically and how he used the trope of offense. Other tropes can include like taqiyya, basically things that are related to the Shi'i tradition that are kind of used to paint Shia Muslims as either non-Muslim or less Muslim. I argue that generally within these regions I'm discussing, these rhetorical tropes grant the Sunni majority permission to silence, ignore, or entirely erase the realities of systematic violence. And that the rhetorical devices reduce anti-Shi'i sectarian violence to matters of theology, and that in focusing strictly on theology, a privilege afforded to only the Sunni majority, it acts as a hegemonic discourse that frames the way in which violence against both Sunni and Shia populations are framed and understood by Muslim communities. And that is it for me. Thank you all very much.